As we enter the third decade of the 21st century, there is no shortage of challenges faced by the global citizenry. Chief among them, worldwide climate change, rising sea levels, more frequent and intense hurricanes, severe droughts, and major floods are just a few of the grim warnings being echoed by climate scientists. And indeed, many of these appear to be occurring in real time. We have arrived at the point where even drastic measures will not reverse the processes set in motion within the course of our lifetimes. The primary focus for the immediate future must be on adaptation over mitigation. But not all regions across the planet will fare the same in the climate crisis. Where some might lose, others might gain. What is the outlook here in Western Colorado? Have we already crossed a dangerous threshold, as some studies suggest? Roughly a decade ago, prompted by his work as a National Weather Service forecaster here in the Grand Junction office, Joe Ramey undertook his own regional study to determine what, if any, climate shifts had occurred throughout the Western Slope region over the course of the past 100 or so years. He joins me to discuss the results of this ongoing study and what they might mean for Western Colorado moving forward into the future. Welcome to Season 3 of the official podcast of Crossing the Divide, a multimedia exploration of life in the Intermountain West. Crossing the Divide counters a media culture fixated on urbanism and elevates a region defined by open space, sweeping vistas, big skies, and natural wonder. I'm Gretchen Reist, guiding you over the divide and into the diverse terrain of the American West. Joe Ramey, welcome to Crossing the Divide.
Thank you, Gretchen. It's nice to be here.
Let's start off with a little bit of your personal history. Are you originally from the Grand Junction area?
I am not. I've been imported, like many Coloradans today. I grew up in southern New Mexico and lived there for most of my, youth. But I always loved the mountains, even growing up in the desert. And went to the mountains whenever I could, avid backpacker, and was lucky enough to eventually end up in Grand Junction with my career.
So what was it that fueled your interest in meteorology and the weather? Were you one of those kids that was kind of always watching what the weather was doing? Did you have your own weather station? What fueled that?
Right. So, no, I grew up, again, down where there are severe thunderstorms in the summer. I basically hid from them. I wasn't out really passionate about them.
You're not a storm chaser, then.
I was not, am not a storm chaser, no. But after high school, I wasn't sure what I was doing. I went to college a short while, and, I was sociology. I have no idea. So I talked to the Air Force. This was 1975. And the Air Force said, yeah, sure, take these tests. I came up eligible to become a weather observer. And I said, here I am, 18, 19 years old. I said, cool, I'll learn about clouds so when I'm backpacking, I'll have some idea of what's going on.
Oh, so practical. Practical
for you. So that's what changed my life. This 19-year-old kid said, oh, I want to learn about clouds. So I went into the Air Force and quickly got really interested in it. And after 4 years, got out and went to school, got a bachelor's degree, and had opportunities to work in meteorology. The field was kind of opening up through the 80s, and I did several jobs that I really enjoyed, every one of them. So.
Now, you worked for the National Weather Service, which falls under the umbrella of the NOAA.
Yes, it's federal government. It's under Department of Commerce. Then NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is part of Department of Commerce. And then the National Weather Service is part of NOAA.
It's interesting to me that that falls under the Department of Commerce. Can you give us some insight into that?
Our mission in the their mission, now that I'm retired, their mission in the National Weather Service is to save lives and property. So there's the property of the commerce portion of our mission as weather forecasters and weather data.
So the field of atmospheric science, there are many different job titles that fall under that category.
Sure.
Could you help us understand, say, what's the difference between a forecaster, which I believe was your title, and a climatologist, for example? Where does one end and another begin?
You know, that's a temporal difference. The weather forecaster is most concerned about the next 24 hours and out to 7 to 10 days. So very short-term waves through the atmosphere. The climatologist is interested in days, but more likely months, years, decades, even centuries. So much longer wavelengths of patterns within the atmosphere.
So is there a different level of education that you need to achieve to, say, go to climatologist, or is it basically the same? It's just what you choose to focus on.
There is a different emphasis for a climatologist. And I was a meteorologist, not a climatologist.
So. Is there any reason why you chose to be a meteorologist as opposed to a climatologist? Any reason?
I was fascinated with the day-to-day forecasting, and that was where, you know, all my jobs kind of pointed me is to the day-to-day forecasting kind of emphasis.
Joe, you were with the National Weather Service here in Grand Junction. I was curious to know what determines where these weather stations are located throughout the country. How is that based? What determines that?
Right. Well, back before the mid-90s, there were approximately one Weather Service forecast office per state. Then in 94, 95, the National Weather Service really wanted to get out into the regional communities to be more on the ground with the customers, whether that's farmers or firefighters, aviation, no matter what those customers were, and be able to have more regional offices. So they opened it up and they created, I think it's 174 offices across the country from, you know, 50-odd up to way more than 150. And that is when Grand Junction opened as a forecast office. Before, the National Weather Service was here releasing balloons and collecting data from different sites. But after the mid-90s, we became a forecast office here. And basically, we filled a hole between Salt Lake and Denver. That was why Grand Junction was chosen.
I have to imagine that in a state like Colorado, where you have huge differences in topography and elevation, having multiple offices would almost be a necessity to get any type of accuracy for each region. Or no?
Well, not necessarily accuracy, but I think, again, having a presence on the ground where you can interact with people, with different agencies and with the public in your communities, instead of being in Denver trying to serve Rangeley and Durango and you know, it just doesn't make sense. You're too far removed. You're perceived as being bureaucratic, and there may be, you know, some truth to that you become Denver centric. I certainly forecasting here on the West Slope, I was Grand Valley centric. I looked at it. I lived in it. You know, every day, and it was more difficult to think about Pagosa Springs or to think about Steamboat Springs. You know, those were outliers for me. So having three offices in the state brought those outliers closer to each office.
What was the forecast region, or what is the forecast region for the office here?
Right. The Grand Junction office is responsible for an area from the Wyoming border down to the New Mexico-Arizona border, from basically the Continental Divide west out to the Green River in Utah.
So in forecasting for that region, what were some of the challenges, or are some of the challenges that you faced, and I'm sure they continue to face, with getting accurate predictions for the weather in this region?
Complex terrain. is really the challenge for Western Colorado. And of course, that has impacts on all kinds of small things like temperatures and, you know, how the winds vary around different mountain ranges through the day. But it also has impacts on the type of weather and the challenges that we have here in Western Colorado. We don't see a lot of severe storms, though we do have our season, you know, in late summer into the fall, that we have pulse storms that can be quite damaging. But really our challenges here were winter storms and also wildfires. So that was continues to be the emphasis of this office. And of course, that's somewhat different than the offices in Pueblo or in Denver, or actually they're in Boulder. But, you know, they're looking at the plains also, and that has severe weather potential that's much larger than here on the West Slope. So having us out here gave us the opportunity as forecasters to really emphasize that winter weather and also fire weather concerns.
When you look at the Grand Valley, are there any specific things about this area that make it unique in terms of weather? And I probably say that more as an observer. I'll tell you, I have seen some really black-looking clouds that look like they were headed right for us. And it just looks like we are going to get hit hard. And 10 minutes later, all those dark clouds have broken up, right, and the sun is shining through. I know we do have certain weather phenomena here that are specific to this valley.
Sure. Well, so what I think you're describing is a very natural observation, that you look, you see a storm cloud heading our way, and somehow it misses us. Often people say it went right around us. That is not true. As I've looked at radar over the last, you know, 2.5 decades, storm clouds don't move around a valley. They are on their linear path. And what happens out here, you're from Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, your daily visibility was probably on the order of 10 to 30 miles, sometimes down to 3 miles because of the greater amount of moisture in the atmosphere, and you're at a lower elevation, so it's a thicker atmosphere that could hold more moisture. And of course, you're closer to an ocean. Here in Western Colorado, we're higher and drier, and our visibilities are very typically 100 miles. So when you look across, you know, across the horizon, you're seeing many more storms than you could see in Pennsylvania. And so you see that storm that's 30 miles away, and you're watching it, and over the next half hour, it dissipates in its normal cycle of, you know, half an hour to an hour. And you think, well, you know, why are these storms just dying before they ever get here? Well, they're not really. You're just able to see more.
Now, we do get these cold and warm weather inversions. Can you speak to that a little bit? And also to that point, we know that when we have these inversions, pollution tends to be worse. And I would be really curious to know how pollution can affect, if it does at all, can affect daily weather.
Okay, yes, complex topic. We could speak about this for a semester, which I have done. Inversions are typically a cold weather event. They don't happen very often in the summertime. We can get inversions, but usually they're not as impactful. And it basically describes that we have cold air trapped under warmer air. And what that does is produce a cap of over a valley, especially in the wintertime. It produces a cap that just, we have to live in our same air day after day after day. We're not having an exchange vertically. And so pollutants get trapped. The particulates can create health hazards, of course. They can have some impact on weather. If we have enough moisture in the atmosphere, those pollutant particles can help to form fog and low-level stratus. We've seen a little bit of that recently here in the Grand Valley in early 2020. So again, mainly a cold weather phenomenon. I hear people, as I was working at the National Weather Service, and people would call in and say, oh, what are the chances of a white Christmas? And I would tell them, and then I'd say, but be careful what you wish for, because if we get snow, significant snow in the Grand Valley, oh, Christmas to New Year's, then we've got this cold layer on the ground. It's reflecting off the sunlight. It's hard for us to warm up. We tend to form inversions. We tend to get pollute, you know, that brown cloud over the Grand Valley. And indeed, that's what we've seen this year. In 2019-20, we had significant snow that fell right around New Year's. And then in the following weeks, we've had several inversion events.
The reason I asked about the pollution, and we'll jump to this later, had to do with the Washington Post study or the article that I think I referenced. The basic idea of it was that climate change does not happen the same everywhere. But it was analyzing data, I think, from either late 1800s, but in many areas after the 1930s, the trend was a rise in temperatures. But they noted that in the South, there was actually a period of cooling. And part of the theory behind that was that having additional particulates in the air could keep some of that, maybe the intensity of the sunlight, I'm not sure. Could you speak to that at all in terms of, you know, pollution and how that might affect weather patterns?
Sure. So generally, well, my career has been spent in the American West, New Mexico, Oregon, and of course, Colorado. And looking at the climate records there were warm years in the 20s, 30s, and 40s that really impacted. You can really see it strongly in the climate record. And that was, you know, our depression, the Dust Bowl days. We had a very arid period there. Many years were quite dry. And what I found was a correlation. If there's less moisture in the atmosphere, we tend to be warmer. So there's a indirect correlation. Moisture goes down, temperatures go up. So we had these warm years. After the 40s, then we started a cooling trend from the 50s, 60s, right into the 70s. And what some folks will say that are skeptical about climate change, they'll say, well, there were climatologists in the 1970s that said we were going to continue to get cooler and cooler. And that is true. There was a minority of climatologists that were trying to explain why we were seeing 20 to 30 years of cooling and trying to project that into the future. What happened in the 70s is that we had the Clean Air Act that went into effect, and we lost much of the particulates. We cleaned our atmosphere, especially, you know, across the nation. And with less particulates in the atmosphere, we had more sunlight hitting the surface, and we saw the warming trend begin that continues to this day.
We know that human beings like to change the landscape, especially in places like the West. How do things like irrigation or an increase in people putting bluegrass in their yard, things that need more water, does that have any impact on local weather?
Well, it does. Very local. Not necessarily even for the whole Grand Valley. If you could sample the whole Grand Valley, irrigation wouldn't have a whole lot of impact because all that water would be here anyway. Now, there is something called urbanization that definitely shows that we are creating warm pockets around cities, in and around cities. So there is that impact of human endeavors. But the one interesting thing about the Grand Valley and actually all of the Intermountain West is that we're really dominated by microclimates. So you have an irrigation ditch, and for, I don't know, you know, 200 meters on either side of that irrigation ditch, you've got a gradient of moisture that wouldn't be there otherwise. Well, that's, you know, a few hundred meters of land. You know, for the whole Grand Valley, that doesn't have a lot of impact. But here in our portion of the world, we're really microclimate dominated. You know, if you live just 50 feet lower down in Fruta, your mornings are going to be colder than in Grand Junction, and Grand Junction is going to have colder mornings than Palisade. That's why Palisade has all of the fruit trees, because they have the mildest mornings and therefore the longest growing season. So microclimates is a real fascinating part of our weather and our climate here in Western Colorado.
I would say that as somebody who's not from here, that's one of the things that fascinates me almost the most about the West is this microclimates. You can see it in the course of a hike. It can be a completely different experience in just a matter of minutes.
Absolutely. And so choose where you put your tent up when you go hiking.
Good thought. Very, very good idea. Thank you for that. As a forecaster, how did you start focusing on broader issues of climate during your time at the National Weather Service here in Grand Junction?
So when I came to the National Weather Service office in Grand Junction in 1999, all forecasters have other duties that we do besides just forecasting the weather. We look at the aviation program, fire weather program, and as I was coming here, I was very excited about fire weather. I really wanted to get involved in fire weather forecasting. I walked into the boss's office on the first few days, and he said, oh, I'm going to give you the climate program. And I was crestfallen. That sounded so boring. And just, you know, I thought, oh, I'll be adding up the monthly totals for different sites, and I'll do top 10 lists of the wettest years on record. And indeed, I did that for the first year or two. Very quickly, though, I found climate compelling. Again, it's weather on a much longer time scale. And so you start to see patterns occurring out beyond, you know, just the 7-day forecast, beyond the 1 month, beyond the 1 year. You start to see different patterns starting to emerge. And so as the climate services focal point, that's what I was called, I would try to bring information from the national or international scale down to users in Western Colorado and Eastern Utah. So occasionally I would get updates from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that would talk about how the climate was changing, the latest science on that. And I would put it out to our public on social media or on our website in small articles and got very little feedback. And I just think it was very hard to digest what this means, you know, on a global or national scale. And so I decided, well, maybe I'll start looking at different sites and through our climate record, try to see if there are any trends visible in our climate record. So, of course, I started with Grand Junction, and our climate record goes back to 1893 for this city. And so I just started looking at temperatures and looking at precipitation, and I, you know, got good with spreadsheets, as all climate people have to be, because you're playing with data. And so I, you know, I plotted out the temperatures for and precipitation for Grand Junction, and I divided it into decades and 30-year periods and looked at it, and I could see, you know, some trends. And I thought, well, that's interesting. What about Montrose? What about Telluride? What about Steamboat Springs? What about Moab? You know, and so I looked through all our climate records, and I chose 11 sites across Western Colorado and Eastern Utah that had long and strong climate records that went back at least into the early 1900s. And I chose 1911 as a starting point. If I went back prior to 1911, it dropped to like 5 or 6 sites. So I wanted more than a handful, and I ended up with 11 sites. And I noticed that each one of those showed some variations, but if I married them all together, I thought it might represent what's actually happening here in our region as a whole. Instead of just the microclimates that we've discussed, the microclimates for here in the Grand Valley or the microclimates in Steamboat Springs, those microclimates would... The theory went, you know, the hypothesis went that those microclimates would fade away and we'd see the trend of the region. So I kind of plotted up that data, those data, and then I thought, well, we've talked about urbanization and how that can impact the climate record. And I thought, well, where's urbanization not occurring? And immediately I thought of our national parks and monuments, where we do not have land use change. Often those sites are not necessarily in valleys. They may be on ridgetops or more complex terrain than nearly all our cities are in valley bottoms. And I thought those data from national parks and monuments would give me a look at how urbanization may or may not be changing our climate. So I plotted those up. The problem with those sites is that most of them started in the 50s and even into the 1960s. So it was a shorter data set, but there it was, 1960s up to 2010 or 14. And I saw the same trends in the national parks and monuments as I did in the 11 sites that I chose across western Colorado and eastern Utah. So I thought that was interesting. I chose a final data set to see if our region was unique or if it was maybe if I could extrapolate out beyond, and I chose surrounding sites. So I went up to Lander, Wyoming, and out to Salt Lake City. I tried to choose not just totally urban data points, so I chose Heber City on the other side of the Wasatch Front, a small town, and down through northern Arizona and northern New Mexico and out onto the plains, Rocky Ford on the Front Range, but also Denver and Fort Collins. And so I chose sites surrounding western Colorado and eastern Utah, plotted all those up together, and sure enough, a very similar climate signal showed up in all three data sets.
When you went into the study, did you go into it with a certain expectation of what you were going to find?
I assumed that we would see warming as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, I'm going to call them IPCC from now on, IPCC said we're seeing warming mainly in the summers and mainly in the maximum temperatures. And I said, okay, well, that's my hypothesis. That's what I think I'll be seeing. And that wasn't exactly what I saw here in western Colorado.
So can you delve into what it was that you found? You said you found similar trends on each of those areas. So what was that trend that you found?
The maximum temperatures, in other words, the daily temperatures over a period of decades or 30-year increments, haven't shown much change. There's some wobble. It was kind of high in the 20s, 30s, 40s, went down in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and then has been climbing very subtly or staying flat into recent years. But the minimum temperatures showed a marked increase starting in the 1970s. And looking at it, it looks like 1975 is probably a good hinge year where the trend of the temperatures seems to change. And right around 1975, we started warming, especially in our minimum temperatures, and that continues to this day.
When you say minimum temperatures, is that the low temperature or just what's the maximum over a period of time and what's the minimum temperature? I guess, could you clarify that a little bit?
Sure. So if I'm plotting this as a decade of temperatures, I am looking at the low temperatures for a decade. So 3,652 data points creates that one temperature for Grand Junction and for Steamboat Springs and also for Durango. So each of those, that one data point is a decade worth of morning low temperatures. And that's where we see the change in the way that I chose to look at how temperatures are evolving. That's where we seem to be seeing the change here in our region.
And that surprised you based on what you were, or wasn't quite what you were expecting to find, or was there a surprise in that data for you at all? Or
right, I would think if you're adding energy to the atmosphere, that if anything, the afternoon high temperatures would be higher, and you know the low temperatures too. Sure, maybe they're dragged along with it, but I would think the daily maximum temperatures that occur in the afternoon, that would be what would be inching up more than the overnight lows. So I found that interesting.
Any explanation, any theory you have as to why that would be?
We've talked a little bit about inversions. Perhaps we're getting less inversions. That doesn't explain all of it, though, because it doesn't seem to be just warmer temperatures in the wintertime. It's spread across the season, across the year. So I'm really not sure. And it's not true at every site that I looked at. Crested Butte and Grand Junction don't show real strong warming. They actually show more warming in the afternoon highs, the maximum temperatures. But if I go right up the hill to Colorado National Monument, you do see it up there. So they're up out of the valley, not stuck down in these winter inversions that we live with here in the valley bottom. And you see strong warming in the minimum temperatures up there at the visitor center at the Colorado National Monument. So interesting things going on.
You mentioned that when you were working on the climate program, you would put out these reports and you weren't getting a lot of feedback. And I think your take on that was that something like climate change is kind of hard for us as humans to wrap our mind around something so big. The way my brain works, I'm thinking, if we see a rise in maximum temperature, that's something that we're going to feel a lot more. If it's suddenly 115 degrees on a, like it was in Paris, I think, last summer, that's something that's very, very noticeable to us. Whereas, you know, if we're asleep, we might not be as cognizant of the fact that it's a little bit warmer at night. Do you think any of those things play into making it harder for people to see or feel the effects of climate change and how that would impact their belief as to whether or not it was happening at all?
Well, certainly a morning low temperature that isn't quite as cold, you know, why are we afraid of that? That sounds pretty nice, actually. If our summer afternoons aren't quite as hot and our winter mornings are not quite as cold, I'm all for that. But what we don't understand is that the small incremental change, and we're only talking about a few degrees Fahrenheit, you know, in change over these decades, those incremental changes start to have impacts on biology systems and, you know, even hydrology to some extent, but especially biology, where we just don't know what the impacts are going to be. We may reach some trigger point that now our climate is going to be very different. Our forests are going to be very different. How much evaporation occurs from our limited water source, that could have large impacts on us. All of these things are driven in ways that we don't fully understand yet. Our climate record, if we go back, and this wasn't me, but folks that go back and look at climate back using tree ring analysis and glacier analysis, they see that our climate has done some radical shifts in the past. On the order of less than a century, we've completely flipped our climate in regions and even in large portions of the Earth's landmass. And so we know that there are trigger points out there, whether it's carbon dioxide or amount of moisture or sunlight that's in the atmosphere, things change incrementally, slowly, slowly, slowly. You reach a trigger point and bam, now we're in a whole new regime. The biology, the atmosphere is behaving totally differently than we've known in the past. We're incrementally changing our atmosphere and we have no idea where the next trigger point is.
The Washington Post recently published an article about a study that was done collecting data showing that Western Colorado and Eastern Utah were one of these pockets where it looked like, based on the data, Western Colorado and Eastern Utah had already exceeded that 2 degrees Celsius threshold. I'd like to get your thoughts on that. It didn't seem like it totally jived with what you ended up with. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, first, that quantification of 2 degrees C is difficult for me. You know, I'm more in the qualitative, you know, that we are seeing warming, and, you know, I'm not sure how much. But that stood out to me as looking really odd. Having spent, you know, nearly 15 years looking at the nuts and bolts of the climate record here in Western Colorado and Eastern Utah at specific sites, at all our cooperative observer sites and the automated towers. And I've seen, you know, missing data, sites that were moved, change in instrumentation. There's all kinds of ways that you can create error into the climate data, and it really has to be taken thoughtfully. I think when you are looking at a national or even a regional scale study, then it's harder to look at the nuts and bolts of what's happened in Montrose over the last 100 years, or in Craig, Colorado, or in Moab, Utah. And it's important to look at all those, because if you have two or three sites that move to a higher elevation, well, your morning lows are going to go up just because they changed site. And so to me, that just did not look like good data.
Getting back to this idea that it can be difficult for the public at large to grasp this idea of climate change or radical climate change happening in such a short period of time. We will see drastic weather events like the polar vortex that we saw last winter. I think it was in the upper Midwest. And people will tend to look at that and say, what are you talking about, global warming? So some of the coldest temperatures I've ever seen in my lifetime. But when you hear climatologists talk, they always emphasize global climate change on this type of scale even is not something that you're going to notice on a daily basis. You have to look at long-term data. In recent past, I have read a number of things that suggest we have hit a point where we are starting to see the effects of climate change on a daily basis. I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
First of all, here, especially here in Western Colorado, I'll keep bringing it back to our home, we see strange weather every week. We have especially cold days. For you and I, yesterday it was snowing. We had 3 inches of snow on the ground here. And today it's sunny and mild. That variation, large daily, hourly, weekly variations, is what is normal here in Western Colorado. In fact, what I say when I would talk about climate to the public is that what we call average is just 30 extreme years averaged together to create something that never really happens. It's just we have extreme events. That's our weather. So if you're adding on a incremental small change to our weather, it's very hard to sense that. We've had large snowstorms in the past. Occasionally we have them now. We had heat waves in the past and droughts in the past. We have them now. What's the big deal? So now we're starting to see on beyond our region, in our region too, of course, but you know, you mentioned the polar vortex. And that seems to have happened over, you know, we've had two or three polar vortex winters in, you know, the last decade. It's a new term. It really just means that we're getting cold air that's coming down from the polar Arctic regions, and it's settling further south. And we're somewhere in the United States and Canada, we're under the influence of this big ball of cold air. So one thought comes to mind is Dr. Jennifer Francis. She's a climatologist out of Rutgers University, and she's done some work that talks about the jet stream as we start to heat up the atmosphere. And if you think about the whole northern hemisphere, the equator is warm and the North Pole is cold. If you're adding more heat to the atmosphere, that gradient between the two is getting less and less. And so you can think of it, the analogy is a stream. If you have a steep hill that a stream is running down, it typically finds its fall line, it goes straight down the mountain. Maybe it has a little bit of curves in it, but it's going straight down the mountain. As that stream gets down into a valley, and now the gradient is less, how much it's going downhill is markedly less, that stream starts to oxbow, starts to curve, and do big bows of movement. And that may be happening in our atmosphere. So as we had a larger gradient, a steeper hill from the equator to the pole back in the 50s, 60s, 70s and prior, then we had a jet stream that was more active. And it moved along, it had dips and it had ridges, but it moved along. Now as we have less temperature gradient between the equator and the pole, our jet stream is more ambling. It kind of creates oxbows. It tends to set up a pattern and stay in that pattern for extended periods of time. And that may be the explanation for why we have these cold outbreaks during the winter. No matter how much CO2 we put in the atmosphere, within reason, we are always going to have ice and snow at our poles. We're always going to have cold air. That's part of our climate. That's how our Earth is tilted, and you know that's our climate. So an outbreak of cold weather does not mean we're not getting warmer. So again, these large cold outbreaks that extend for long periods of time may indeed be a strong signal of climate change.
That would, I assume, would also explain what they're talking about with these huge variances. So you'll be inundated with rain, and then you'll have all this period of drought. Is that kind of along those lines?
Absolutely. So a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture, and storms will tend to maybe stay in place longer, not move along as fast in our future climate and in our present climate. So an atmosphere that can hold more moisture that tends to stay in one place longer or stay away from one place longer, you're going to have heavier rain events and you're going to have larger dry events, drought. We shouldn't be making decisions about our grandchildren's future based on how we feel. You know, this can be measured. This can be science. It can be proven in a scientific way. Mm-hmm. And so when I hear people talk about, oh, do you believe in climate change? This is not a spiritual topic. This is not an act of faith. This is science. Whether, you know, there will be groups, there will be people that will have some vested interest in creating controversy and creating doubt. But the science is strong, and it's there that we are changing our climate in ways that we don't understand, with impacts that we will only know once we are there. It's a great big experiment that we're doing. I think you talk about, well, you know, how do we mitigate? How do we deal with stronger weather changes in the future? And that everybody can get on board with. You know, I think it doesn't have to be a debate, a philosophical debate about man's place on the planet and if we have a right to produce, cut every tree and produce pollution that kills off other species. That kind of debate is pointless. It takes us nowhere as a society. But we can talk about how we're going to react into the future, you know, and that's where we can have agreement and we can build bridges across between two different groups and find common ground.
Yeah, you talk about the discussion of how to mitigate. Probably most of climate change is going to have a negative impact, but it doesn't mean that an area will completely die out. The wine industry, for example, was something I read about recently. It's more an issue of certain varietals that used to grow really well in a certain region aren't going to grow so well here. How do we change what we grow where? It's not necessarily that it's all hope lost, but things are going to change. Flora and fauna are going to change. And how do we adapt to those changes?
Out at the world view, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has always said that there are going to be winners and losers. As we change the climate, Norway and Sweden are going to be a little more habitable. You know, it's going to be a little better living up there in Northern Europe and in Northern Asia. And yes, how at the local level, maybe the orchards and the vineyards in Palisade will move a little closer to Clifton. You know, I mean, or that area further into the valley will be now become viable for growing fruit. Whereas over our climate history, it's just they've had too short of a growing season to do well with those crops. So, you know, it's really interesting because it's at all levels of climate, at a world level, a national level, regional, and even right down to portions of the valley, how this will impact. You know, if you live on 32 Road, you know, should you be thinking about, you know, putting in some grapes?
Yeah, interesting. I like that point about the winners and losers. And of course, it still all remains to be seen. You know, we're in it.
Sure. And we don't know.
We
just don't know.
And even the scientists who are on the cutting edge of the research can't say for certain. I mean, I think we're finding all the time that this is accelerating at a much faster pace than most people even predicted.
Yep. So the IPCC would put out different scenarios based on amount of carbon dioxide that we were using into the future, and then they would have projections. And we are bumping up against worst case scenarios as we see results. You know, it is not the slower process; it is the faster process. I think I lived at a really good time. You know, born in the 50s. I saw us go to the moon. I saw the Berlin Wall come down. I saw the diminishing of war, but I really worry.
Joe, you've been pretty outspoken about the fact that as a forecaster and in the work that you've done over decades, you believe the climate science. The climate is changing. As somebody who has been privy to that information, how has it changed your own life? How you live?
Well, I'm certainly not completely climate clean. I love to ski, and so I do a 100-mile round trip to go up to the Grand Mesa to cross-country ski on top or to downhill at Powderhorn. I love to do that. I try to carpool when I can, but you know, there are those days when I want to go alone and do whatever I want to do. So, you know, my lifestyle continues to be somewhat opulent. But as my wife and I, who is also a forecaster, and we retired on the same day, as we were looking at these data, we decided that we wanted to put solar panels on our house. And there was not the economic incentive to, you know, we weren't going to be paid back in just a few years for dropping several thousand dollars to put solar panels on our house. But we did it because we believe in that. And we wanted to, you know, to walk the walk. She drives a Prius. I drive a Honda Element because it carries a lot of stuff. But, you know, it's a low emission vehicle. So we're always trying to balance those things. I love to ride bikes, and I try to use my bicycle. You know, I commuted for my coworkers at the National Weather Service office. You know, I was the dorky guy that always rode my bike to work, even in the snowstorms. And so I've made modifications to my lifestyle. I still drive a car. I drive, not an economical car necessarily. And we have modified our house a lot. We've put in new windows throughout. We've put a lot of insulation in, so we've tried to lessen our impact. We put in a much more efficient boiler, took out our old boiler and put in a 95% efficient boiler. So we've done small things. I think not enough. I think we've done some things, but not enough. We still like to take trips. We're hoping to send our granddaughter to Costa Rica here this spring, and we're hoping to go to Ireland this summer, and that's a huge CO2 carbon footprint right there. So it's a balance. You know, you have to live your life, I think, and but at the same time, you try to think of the impacts from, you know, buying a sweater to buying a car to taking a trip. You know, I try to always have some environmental impact in mind as I'm making those choices. What I do personally has no impact on the world as far as energy use. But me and my neighbors and, you know, the state and the whole region, well, now all of us doing a little bit starts to have a significant impact, a changeable impact. How you incentivize people to want to take those changes is a difficult question. You know, I think that's, in my mind, that's the role of government, is to create incentives for people to make the right choices and to make it expensive to make the wrong choices. But, you know, if you're listening to this impact, you probably care about your impact on the world. And what you do as an individual can make a difference if it's multiplied by all of us.
Well, Joe, this has been a fascinating conversation with you. Thank you so much for coming in here today and dragging yourself out of retirement.
Oh, thank you.
To talk about things that you probably don't talk about on a daily basis anymore. I know it's been a little while, but I really appreciate it, and I'm sure our listeners do as well. As we sign off, any thoughts you'd like to leave us with?
Well, you know, as we talk about climate change, there's a lot of doomsday talk, and indeed it's very serious and it's very large, and we can all feel like we have no power in this. But boy, you know, we've had problems. You know, the Black Plague was nothing to sneeze at, I'm sure. And mutually assured destruction when I was a child, when we had thousands of nuclear warheads armed and ready to go. And, you know, we find ways out. Once we decide as a species to do something, by God, we go to the moon. You know, I mean, in just a few years, we go to the moon. It's incredible what we can do. There is no reason to think that our true altruistic side of humanity is dead and buried. You know, I think we have great days ahead of us.
And with that, we close out season 3 of Crossing the Divide. Thanks for tuning in over the course of a crazy, unpredictable 2020. Due to pandemic complications and a potential expansion of the podcast in the very near future, we might experience a lapse in programming before resuming with season 4. This would be the perfect time to catch up on any podcast releases you might have missed over the last 3 seasons. As always, you can access our full lineup of conversations with Western Voices by searching Crossing the Divide on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Hit subscribe to stay plugged in to each new episode. Follow Crossing the Divide on Facebook and Instagram to keep up on podcast releases and access exclusive video and photography. And to catch our 4-week Facebook series, Deep Roots, an in-depth profile of life in Parachute, Colorado, as told by many longtime residents. This series will premiere in early January and is created by our fall CMU intern, Logan McClung. Until our next podcast hits the stream, I wish you all well heading into the new year, and look forward to bringing you a new season of Voices West of the Continental Divide. Crossing the Divide, a voice for the Intermountain West. Support for Crossing the Divide comes from Rocky Mountain PBS, Mesa County Libraries, and the Daily Sentinel.